This is the Irrationally Exuberant. I'm Reed Messerschmidt.
The year was 1935. Dust and hunger engulfed the land, American land, like the punishingly floral perfume of an overzealous aunt, her bosom heaving with glee and hysterical sobs in equal measure. Swing was king, but overpacked jalopies were its homely queen, rail-riding hobos their shameful progeny. The hobos might have been dukes or earls or something, come to think of it. The shameful progeny would be Jim Crow, maybe? Soup kitchens? Hoover? He was out of office by then, but I suppose he could be a duchess. It matters not. Suffice it to say that times were tough, which you already know. In my experience, the Great Depression was tough and Hitler was bad, along with a vague composite of Rosa Parks and Harriet Tubman, are just about the only things anyone retains from high school history class. But it bears repeating. Times were tough. Rose of Sharon had to feed that poor man from the milk-engorged teat meant for her Paris child, for cripe's sake. It was heartbreaking. It remains heartbreaking. So things were tough and folks were miserable and their bean consumption was soaring on account of the still quite reasonable price of beans, which were then colloquially known as boxcar caviar or little bindle steaks or, less often, the San Fernando special. So, and excuse me for going blue here, but it needs to be said. Someone needs to say it. They were gassy as well. And among those miserable, gassy folks were Orland Stumbo and his family. And doggone it, I'm just going to come out and say it. They stunk. Like a crusty mutt running rampant through a canned tuna factory with a busted AC unit, they, and all old-timey people really, smelled just terrible. From the split tips of their matted hair up to their greasy, flaking scalp, all the way down to their raw-rubbed, begrimed, scab-dappled crotches and calloused, gnarled, ungodly feet. Think about the rankest person you know. That person, and who are we fooling? It's Jeff, right? That person smells like Prince grinding fresh coffee beans in a ladies' lotion wholesaler compared to even the fanciest and most well-to-do old-timey person. These people I'm speaking of, the Stumbos, they were neither fancy nor well-to-do. They were Okies, and they were hauling ass out of California. They'd come there, as Okies did, to find work, but all they'd found was the business end of Johnny Law's Billy Club, and they hadn't much cotton to that. So they thought they'd try their luck in Washington. A bit about the Stumbos. In addition to Orrin, who was a deeply grizzled 28 years old, that's 86 in Okie years, with a heart of mostly gold, but also there was a fair bit of racism in there too. Old-timey people were across-the-board racist in addition to being smelly. There was also his sunken-eyed, thin-haired wife, Jarcy May, and their four raggedy kids, Birdie Sue, Orrin Jr., Hap, and Lil' Kevin. There had been three more children, Birdie Sue's identical twin sister, Gertie Sue, Apple, and Big Kevin, but they hadn't survived the bout of scurvy the family had weathered and were buried, ironically, though everyone was too sad to get the joke, beneath an orange tree back at an orange grove in the Salinas Valley. Now, to get to Washington from California way, of course, you've got to kick up some dirt in Oregon, which is what the remaining Stumbos were doing when this story begins. Specifically, they were kicking up dirt along the Rogue River, a body of water primarily known for its dishonesty and lack of principle. The Stumbos were sullenly traversing the river's winding banks just outside of Gold Hill, so named because of the preponderance of gold mining interests and hills within its city limits, not to mention the notorious dearth of imagination within the gold mining community. On their way to nowhere in particular, when they came across a most peculiar hand-painted sign. Everything was artisanal back then, you see. The meticulously painted sign read, "The Vortex, 7 miles." An arrow below the text pointed northeast. Now, the Stumbos didn't know a vortex from a zune, and to be fair, neither did the man that named it, as the Gold Hill Vortex did not and does not fulfill any part of the actual dictionary definition of the word vortex. but they were intrigued and hungry and figured it was as good a direction to go as any. So they aligned the wheels of their jalopy with the northeast-bound muddy ruts that passed for a road and headed towards whatever awaited them at the vortex. 2 days and 7 miles later, they arrived at another sign. This one at the foot of a large, pine-covered hill. Except for Oren Jr., who had finally succumbed to tuberculosis. The sign said, "You have reached the vortex," and featured a crude drawing of what was, they assumed, the vortex itself. The sign had an arrow pointing up the hill. The vortex, if the sign was to be believed, was a rickety wooden shack. The Stumbos were elated. It was the least rickety shack they'd seen in months. Why, whoever lives there must barely be starving. Mayhap we can murder them and eat what little they have, cried Jarcy May. There was barely enough of Junior to go around, God rest his soul, and I'm powerful hungry. Oren nodded stoically and spit on the ground. Okie for, yep. And they were all preparing to hop out of the car when a tall, well-built man with sparkling blue eyes, impeccably dressed in the manner of a kind of professor meets dandy meets Sherlock Holmes thing that was popular at the time among a particular set, emerged from the tree line and cheerily strode towards the family. "Good afternoon, folks," he shouted merrily. "I presume you are here to experience the vortex." The Stumbos stared at him with their mouths agape, breathing loudly from their noses. The man was John Litster, a mining engineer, poet, huckster, and the owner of the vortex. At 49 years old, he was hale and hearty and full of good cheer. He was a Scot by birth, though his accent didn't betray his origins. But he may as well have been from Pubitron Ferglevin as far as the Stumbos were concerned.
I reckon we are," said Oren, as Hap, a dim-witted behemoth, slowly lowered the large, half-whittled stick he'd intended to brain the man with. "Well then, come with me. We've no time to waste. Mysteries and wonder await. We're going to have a lot of fun."
"Fun," said Oren, as though he was hearing the word for the first time and had to work out its pronunciation. They all got out of the car, their heads in a fog of hunger, confusion, and their own collective musk, and ambled silently behind Mr. Litster into the unknown. Litster had purchased the land that he eventually named the Vortex 15 years earlier. He was looking for a fresh start after a stint in San Quentin for making off with $14,000 he was supposed to have delivered to a blind pimp named Swollen Floyd DeBouge and blowing it on dice, whores, booze, and an ill-fated pet orangutan he named Swollen Floyd DeBouge in honor of the man whose money he had used to purchase the beast. Swollen Floyd DeBouge the orangutan ran away just 3 days after his purchase and was gunned down by a sheriff's deputy just outside of Barstow for himself making off with a significant amount of money, for an orangutan anyway, that he'd grabbed from the register of, appropriately enough, Orange Harry's saloon, where he'd been pounding back shots and fondling whores to the great amusement of the bar's other patrons. The deputy that took him down turned out to be none other than famed German silent actor Emil Jannings, who was in the United States researching an upcoming role as a hapless sheriff's deputy in a never-completed comedy called Fat Cops. When Litster got out of the clink, he didn't have a lot of money. But luckily, the folks selling the land weren't asking for a lot of money on account of, apparently, the land was cursed, or they believed it to be cursed anyhow, a belief that went back to before Gold Hill was a mining concern at all, back when it was still under the benevolent jurisdiction of the Tillamook Indians. The Tillamook were under the impression, where they got this impression, no one can say, that the trickster Coyote had worked some of his hoodoo on the land for one reason or another. More than likely, it was some petty territorial thing, and he just wanted some peace and quiet. What with all the incessant chirping of various warblers and chickadees, and the constant mysterious machinations of the crow. The result of his hoodoo was a place where all animals fear to tread, and the laws of physics as we know them do not apply. The gold miners that sold the land to Litster discovered this the hard way.
They were irritated to find that their boroughs and what have you were unwilling to cooperate with their operation, and that all of their surveying gizmos were even more useless than the boroughs, which, like I said, is really saying something. They couldn't seem to tell magnetic north from a zoon, as the saying goes. It all came to a head when the wooden, two-room building they had erected as an assaying office and temporary shelter from the elements, in which one filthy, gap-toothed miner or another could relieve himself of his manly burden, so to speak, came unstuck from the forest floor it was erected upon while old Rodney Blunk was inside doing God knows what and slid towards Sardine Creek, so named because of the rotten stench its water emitted on account of all the miners and deer and bears and porcupines and such that were shitting in and around it constantly, so that it smelled like a tin of sardines left in the July sun for too long, and came to rest against the gnarled trunk of an old sweet gum tree. Now, the shock of this sudden and unexpected relocation was too much for old Blunk, who wasn't particularly mentally stable to begin with due to a codependent mother and absentee father, not to mention the massive amounts of toilet hooch he put away on a daily basis. He lost his mind completely and ran off into the trees, never to be officially seen or heard from again, though sightings continued right on through the 1970s. The loss of Rodney Blunk was the final straw for the company, and they put the land up for sale that very afternoon. No one bothered to tell Litster about these stories, of course, but he found out the nature of his purchase as soon as he set foot, or his horse refused to set foot, I should say, causing him to have to dismount from the horse and set his own damned foot on his newly acquired land, though he presumably didn't attribute the anomalies he experienced to a coyote, trickster, or otherwise. He was a scientist, after all. A mining engineer, though documentation has yet to be found that he was accredited or received any schooling on the topic. Not an uncommon situation in those days. Clarence Birdseye, for instance, the man who invented frozen dinners, was neither a French-trained chef or a refrigerator professional, but rather a third-grade dropout with nothing more than a pound of horse meat, a fistful of peas, a block of ice, a rumbling tummy, and a dream. So Litster was a scientist of sorts, and as sort of scientists tended to be in the first few decades of the 20th century, he was also a Fortean. A Fortean is, and listen, this episode is about mystery spots, gravity houses, what have you, those roadside attractions you can find all over this great nation of ours that make you feel sick, and we're just about there, I promise. Forteans are, in the most basic sense, admirers and acolytes of Edward Fort, the somewhat famed paranormal investigator in quotes here, as he basically just sat in a library and compiled paranormal reports, no Venkman he, and author of The Book of the Damned, as well as, according to his biography, 10 novels, only one of which was published and to little fanfare. Basically, Fort and the Forteans were, and to some degree are, devoted to applying the scientific method to studying subjects outside of the realm of accepted science. Hobgoblins and ghouls and haints and Draculas and werewolves and the like. As I said, this was a very popular pursuit for a time, occupying much of the attention of notable brainiacs like H.L. Mencken, Theodore Dreiser, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and Booth Tarkington, with the arduous task of deciding whether ectoplasm was real, which it is absolutely not, of course. But you could have fooled them, and many did. Mostly old ladies with a thing for candles and an uncanny ability to impersonate dead aunts. The scientific method can only get you so far when all of your quote-unquote medicines are made of liquor, cocaine, and opium, and everybody's rotting from the inside due to untreated syphilis. Anyway, it was kind of a steampunk Victorian holdover that was on its way out and couldn't have been more at odds with the world that the Stumbos inhabited. It's unclear whether Litster purchased the Gold Hill land with the intent of applying his Fortean principles to its mysteries, or if he knew about its mysteries at all, but that's what happened. When his horse, Broadway Dennis, a trusty Arab steed that appeared in the 1921 Western Kickeroo under none other than Hoot Gibson, but was blacklisted after the film's premiere for giving Hoot, who was notoriously salty, a sloppy tongue bath that smeared his ample makeup and knocked off his cowboy hat, revealing a bald, deeply sunburnt head stamped with a crude tattoo of a nude and very well-endowed Bluto, Popeye's burly nemesis, refused to continue onto the land. Litster knew something was amiss. Broadway Dennis was the bravest mammal he'd ever known, and he'd known his fair share of mammals, many of them quite brave. Litster proceeded on foot and immediately felt dizzy and short. The trek is detailed in his memoir, which remains unpublished, mostly because folks don't give three sniffs about John Litster, but also because he bafflingly titled it John Litster, Sexual Scientist. And most of its 1,500 pages document his penis and its oft-upsetting post-Victorian escapades. An excerpt.
"Why, that's curious," I thought, "my penis harder than the stony face of Mount Hood. I usually feel quite tall and impeccably balanced, not to mention down to clown." I pressed on and the sensation grew stronger. By the time the cabin came into view, my feet were almost too heavy to lift, and I'd shrunk by a full foot. By the time I'd reached the cabin, the effects had reversed. I felt light as a silk cock ring and estimate my height to have been 6'6", 4 inches greater than my usual height. Sadly, my penis remained its usual size, 6 3/4 inches long and 1 1/4 inch in diameter. Nothing to sneeze at, certainly, but also nothing to gasp about. It was, as always, and as I mentioned previously, fully erect. The cabin is a wreck, tilted to almost 45 degrees, and by all appearances, barely standing. I gingerly stepped through its slanted door, tired and eager for respite, but upon entering, I became even more disoriented, as though I'd ingested the flower of the lotus plant and hung myself from one of my many terrifying sex contraptions. Nothing in the room was as it should have been. The walls were not flush, the air felt heavy, and my very body seemed to bend in unnatural ways. My penis, in particular, was very twisty. I vomited mightily and was horrified when the vomit, just before splattering upon the floor, changed course and flowed up and back into my mouth, causing me to vomit once more, and again the reversal took place and again it caused me to vomit. This revolting loop lasted for close to an hour, when, unable to take any more, I fled from the shack's nightmarish walls and made my way in as close to a sprint as possible back to where Broadway Dennis still stood as stalwart as ever. Have I unwittingly stepped into a Lewis Carroll whimsy? Have I gone mad? But if I've gone mad, then so has Broadway Dennis, and he's the sanest mammal I've ever known. Perhaps I've been bedeviled by a wood nymph. I should like to find this nymph and punish it in a consensual way that would bring us both to the ecstatic heights of sexual pleasure.
I'll spare you the rest of the journal entry. Litster set about applying his 14 principles to discovering what was causing the phenomena he'd experienced. According to himself, he performed over 14,000 experiments. Far more of them than is reasonable, of course, involved his sex organ, a term scientists sometimes use to describe a penis. I won't get into any of those as we have already discussed this man's member far more than I'm comfortable with, but the other non-penile experiments included such in-depth scientific analyses as rolling a ball uphill and standing a broom on end. Shockingly, Litster was never recognized by the stiffnecks on the Nobel Committee. He concluded that the vortex was a sphere of energy half underground, half above ground, and named it the vortex on the recommendation of Albert E. Page, a prominent Fortean and noted dipshit who was once convinced to purchase a worthless plot of marshland by an old lady in a sheet claiming to be the ghost of his father. There were Fortians that disagreed with Page's assessment. Gulliver Boxwain, for instance, believed that the gravitational anomalies experienced there were the result of a machine buried in prehistoric times, probably by Atlanteans. This seemed perfectly reasonable to Litster, though he found that it was a little much for most people, as were the more lewd of his experiments, and primarily stuck to the vortex thing when describing the area to visitors, as he was now describing it to the Stumbos.
The vortex, you see, is a scientific anomaly of the first order. Not so much an exception that proves the rule, as one that challenges the very notion of an underlying law of physics as we know it today, and suggests an invisible world all around us that is more curious than anything previously dreamt of.
The Stumbos continued to loudly breathe through their noses. Hap swooned with hunger as they trudged up the hill. Gertie Sue, the most educated member of the family, had only just begun second grade when she was pulled from the school to help around the house. They had no idea what was going on.
The plumb lines in this area are deflected 7.5 degrees from perpendicular, and all non-magnetic matter are markedly pushed away from magnetic north with a force of 25 pounds. Birds will not nest here. And as you will soon see, a person's very cellular makeup can be changed depending on where in the vortex they stand.
Plums? Hap asked hopefully.
They arrived at a clearing halfway up the hill, marked off by a plank of wood embedded in the ground.
You, big fella!
Litster gestured at Hap and then, when the boy just stared at him blankly, guided him by the arm to one side of the plank. Hap half-heartedly attempted to gnaw his arm.
Stand right there. Now, sir, if it wouldn't be too much trouble, please inspect the plank your beefy progeny is standing upon and assure us all that it is level.
Orin obediently dropped to one bony knee to inspect the plank. He nodded and spat.
Fantastic. Now, young miss, will you please stand opposite your burly brother?
Bertie Sue did as she was told.
Very good, very good. You can see that this portly oaf is a good 1.5 feet taller than the petite lass. Now, please, switch sides.
They did so. The effect was remarkable. Bertie Sue appeared to be a full 1 foot taller, the top of her head reaching to Hap's damp, drooping lower lip. The family collectively gasped in horror as what little they still understood about the world crumbled below their feet like so much feta cheese, which they had never heard of. So much had been taken from them, so much had changed, and now to learn that even the constancy of gravity and the fabric of one's very being could not be relied upon? It was too much to bear. Orin's will was finally broken. He silently vowed that he would drive himself and what was left of his wretched family over the next cliff they came across. Jarcy May fell to the ground, unconscious, though it may have been from hunger. The family assumed she was dead, and no one bothered to stoop to her aid. Lil Kevin began to wail. Hap thought about a cat. Litster was too caught up in the splendor of the moment to notice any of this.
You see? Do you see? Isn't it remarkable? But the greatest mysteries of all lie in the cabin just a few more paces this way. Follow me.
The Stumbos didn't know what else to do, so they followed him, including Jarcy May, who was again conscious and on her feet. She had a leaf stuck to the side of her gaunt face, but didn't bother to remove it. Litster stopped them just outside of the cabin door.
Now, steel yourselves, friends, for the forces of the vortex are at their strongest in here, its exact center.
They stepped inside, one after the other. The effect was immediate. Orin and Gertie Sue stutter-stepped into each other as though they'd just polished off a jug of toilet wine and began to violently dry-heave from something akin to seasickness as though they'd just polished off a jug of toilet wine. Orin's vision, blinded with tears, he put the ragged sole of his boot down hard to regain his balance. It landed on his daughter's hunger-withered calf, snapping the tibia and fibula with a sickening crack. It was impossible to tell if the strange akimbo of her leg was a result of the break, the forces of the vortex, or both. In any case, it didn't look good.
Jarcee Mae passed out again. Her body fell unsettlingly sideways and rolled up the slanted floor towards Hap, spooking him. He roared and toppled backwards, forwards, up, down. Who could tell anymore? It was complete chaos. He instinctively grabbed little Kevin by the ankle and pulled him down to him for comfort and held him in a mighty bear's hug. The child was crushed against Hap's meaty chest before the young lad could even whimper a protest. Hap furtively pet the matted hair on the lifeless head, chanting, "It's okay, it's okay." Litster looked on in horror, but not surprise. He'd been exhibiting the vortex for 5 years and had seen such a commotion on many occasions. He knew what he had to do, had almost gotten used to it by now. These people would never be the same. For some, the effects of the vortex were just too much. He strode purposefully to the rear of the shack and took hold of the splintered handle of a rusted shovel he kept there, took a deep, centering breath, walked back into the shed, and put the remaining stumbos out of their misery. He buried them somewhere beyond the tree line, and legend has it, when the winds blow just so through the knotty pines, you can still hear Hap faintly chanting from all around and nowhere in particular. "It's okay, it's okay." John Litster continued to run the Oregon Vortex until his death in 1959 from, you guessed it, untreated chlamydia. He left it to his long-suffering wife, Martha, who promptly sold it to a Mr. and Mrs. Garland Overby, who left it to their children, the current owners. In the years after the Stumbo incident, the world's knowledge of physics and optical illusions increased dramatically, due in no part at all to the Fortians, and reactions to the wonders of the area muted from madness and murder to good-natured curiosity. The new owners responded to this change in perception and marketed the Vortex as a family destination, not a scientific one, as no scientists had bothered to come to the Vortex anyway. It became a wildly successful tourist stop in the 40s and has remained so to varying degrees to this day, as well as inspiring dozens of imitators across the country. We'll discuss these pretenders to the gravitational throne and how they managed to imitate the effects of a buried, prehistoric gravity machine, as well as exploring some of my own family history after this brief commercial break.
There. I am Unsettling Frank, disgraced former host of KQRV Tuscaloosa's Macabre Midnight Radio Hour, and I am here to invite you to join me for the most unsettling 12-day road trip tour of haunted rest areas within the United States Central Time Zone, as delineated by the International Meridian Conference, that you will ever experience. Guaranteed. My haunted rest area tour will take you all the way from the ghoul-infested stalls of the ladies' rooms at the Shechonga H Fountain, Memorial Rest Stop, and Dog Park, just outside of Pensacola, Florida, all the way up to the haunted mirrors of the now-defunct Jermish Cox Rest Area in beautiful Fortuna, North Dakota, right off of Old Highway 85. All in my classic royal blue 1987 Chevrolet Celebrity station wagon, famous to the fickle and frankly hurtful folks of Tuscaloosa as the Shame Wagon. I've only got 6 available seats in my automobile, and 2 of those are facing backwards, and only 3 of the spots have functioning safety belts that I can find anyway. The others are probably tucked away into one of the cracks of the seat, so if you can find it, you're of course free to use it. So reserve your spot today. On our grand journey, we'll see such renowned and terrifying sights as the infamous Satan's Glory Hole in the men's room of the Big Spunk Rest Stop along the beautiful Big Spunk River in Minnesota. Marvel at the leering apparitions that peer through the very small rectangular windows of arguable function just above the stand-up johns at the Rude Hollow Rest Area northeast of Mule Shoe, Texas, and gape in horror as the odorous hobgoblins of the aptly named Paul Van Gool Commemorative Rest Area on the outskirts of Arnold's Park, Iowa, spread their horrid musk in unexpected and, dare I say, unsettling ways. It will be a real blast. We'll sleep beneath the gorgeous Midwestern skies and dine upon the finest foods that our nation's gas stations have to offer, not to mention getting to know each other unsettlingly well, all within the most memorable 12 days you're ever likely to experience. So, like I said, reserve your spot today by sending me an email at unsettlingfrank432@AOL.com with all of your pertinent information. See you soon, hopefully.
The year was 1997. Post-grunge and bird flu were the pestilence de rigueur. Duncan Sheik was king, sliding door minivans his matronly queen, John Popper their portly court jester. They didn't have any progeny, shameful or otherwise. It was the 90s after all, and the world was no place for a baby. Hobos were still around, of course, but hobos are much less romantic in color, and a good many of them were registered sex offenders. Let's see, the Duke would have been Greg from Dharma and Greg, and Ross Perot was an Earl. There. I was 14, behemp necklaced, per the fashion of the day, my brain filled with Pearl Jam lyrics and other bullshit. Like the Okies of old, my family, the Messerschmitts, were fleeing the home front in search of woodier dells, the Wisconsin dells in particular. Not to find work, the opposite really, but as a respite from the commonplace. A summer's vacation, as they say. Our lives had become tedious, each in its own way, and we'd grown weary. My father, Rock, had grown weary of his marriage. His throat had grown sore from all the yelling of curses, and his eyes had grown tired from staring desperately back at themselves in his bathroom mirror as he racked his heart and brain for the courage and justification to abandon us, his four-headed albatross. My mother, Cindy, had grown weary of being the lead head of that albatross, herself, in other words, not to mention waterlogged from slurping down her own tears. My brothers, Chad and Ryan, and I had grown weary of the whole damnable charade. It was an emotional dust bowl, a familial Great Depression, a modern Hoover administration. We needed to rinse the sad silt from our skin and hair, and the best place for a middle-class Midwestern, mid-everything family to do that is a tourist trap embattled collection of water parks just east of the center of Wisconsin. Listen, I'm not going to go into detail here. I'm just trying to draw ironic parallels between my childhood and the Western migration of the 30s. You get that, right? And it's not really working. Right. I mean, the stumble thing was fun, but enough is enough. I don't want to be dramatic, after all. So the intention of this whole pain charade was to get us to the Wonder Spot, an Oregon Vortex knockoff just outside of the Dells, and hey, what do you know? Here we are. The Wonder Spot it closed in 2006, one of around 15 of its kind scattered around this great nation of ours. They're typically called Mystery Spots, or Dave's House of Mystery, or Glenn's Gravity Shack, or some such thing. Saggy Susan's House of Unusual Tilting is a further possible, though unlikely, example. These various Mystery Spots don't have prehistoric machines built underneath them that we know about. I'm not sure anyone's bothered to check. They are but pale imitations of Litzker's vortex, mere mind-boggling optical illusions lovingly crafted in concert with nature's glory to delight and educate passers-through for a reasonable fee. What a sham. Oh sure, the squirrely, pimple-pocked theater kid that leads you through the mystery spot will spin some half-cocked yarn about magnetic rocks or the magic of the forest, but these tales are as flimsy as the collar of a thrift store polo, and not a one of these pubescent summer docents will insist upon them with a stern finger in his face. I'll walk you through the experience as, and I hate to boast, but the situation calls for it. I've been to three of these things, two of them twice. Close your eyes. Now visualize, goddamn you, visualize. You exit your parents' minivan, stretching your body like a massive, mostly hairless cat bedecked in a Soul Asylum t-shirt as the smell of flatulence and snack foods and an almost audible release of the pressure inside pour from the sliding door behind you. Your family is there and problematic as usual, but we won't get into that. You are in your own world, the emotive grunts of Eddie Vedder still bouncing through your head and your heart. The van is parked on a grassy clearing in a hilly, wooded area. This makeshift parking lot is about half full, and other families, some more, some less problematic than your own, you suppose, are emerging from their minivans as well, or getting into them. You found this place because your family is on their way to the Dells or Mount Rushmore or some such thing, and there have been signs about the mystery spot every couple of miles for 200 miles or so. Some real Tesla shit. And by the time you got to the sign pointing out the exit to take to actually, finally, get to the fucking thing, you had seen so many signs that your spirit was broken and you just did what it told you to do. Now you're walking up a ramp towards the log cabin and another sign. Welcome to the mystery spot. You step inside. It doesn't seem very mysterious. In fact, it seems like a shop selling garbage souvenirs and garbage, borderline insulting, all the way insulting in retrospect, replica Native American paraphernalia. Your dad pays for the tickets and you wait to be called for the next tour, biding your time by perusing the geodes. You consider buying a geode before remembering that you bought a geode at a truck stop on your way to something very similar to this last year, and it's sitting in your closet and you don't even like looking at it because for some reason it makes you think of biting it, and that seems really unpleasant. The next tour is called over an unnecessary for a room this size PA, and you and three or four other families gather by the cabin's rear door. The other families seem like funhouse mirror images of your family, to varying degrees. Us, but morbidly obese. Us, but Korean. Us, but holding it together a bit better. A childless adult couple, for some reason. Years later, you will be one half of such a couple, and it will make perfect sense. You notice that the group behind you is one large Hutterite family. It strikes you as odd at first, but really, this is kind of an ideal tourist destination for a group that prides itself on their quaint, simplistic way of life. A cabin in the woods and some landscape-based optical illusions is about as quaint as it gets. It sure beats Savers, the only other place you ever seem to see these folks. A teenager, the theater kid previously described, meets you at the doorway. He is wearing a t-shirt, khaki pants, hiking boots, and a smile. You admire his confidence. The show is about to begin.
Can everybody hear me?
Shouts the boy. The entire group is within 2.5 feet of his mouth. His breath smells like a Subway sandwich.
Well, all right. I'll take that as a yes. My name is Jordan, no relation to Air Jordan, although I have been known to slam dunk a basketball from time to time.
He cocks his elbow over his head and sticks out his tongue. Everybody laughs. The inapt comparison and image of this young man, clearly no athlete and white to boot, flying through the air towards a basketball hoop is preposterous. Jordan has everyone eating out of the palm of his hand as though he had an outstretched fistful of the exorbitantly priced caramel corn that is tastefully displayed next to the cash register. Jordan proceeds, bolstered by the adulation.
Not to bum everyone out, but we do have a few ground rules to go over before we get started.
The morbidly obese mother boos. Is she a plant? Who would do that? Jordan is delighted. He points at her sternly.
You come see me after class, young lady.
He is obviously a member of his school's improv troupe. They are definitely called Julia's Seizures or Ad Liberation.
Rule number one, and this is the most important rule, which is why it's number one, have fun. Is that going to be a problem for anyone?
It doesn't appear that it will.
Rule number two is two rules. Stay on the path until we get to the cabin, and please leave anything you come across where you found it. That means you, sir.
He points at the Korean father, who holds up his arms in surrender and grins. It will become clear over the next half hour that he doesn't speak a word of English. What a fun bunch. Anyway, you can stop visualizing now. I'll just tell you about the rest normal style. Jordan capably leads the group through the whole spiel. He explains the mystery spot's origin story. In this case, a meteor crashed to Earth and caused a magnetic anomaly that exists to this day. Native Americans, miners, he covers it all. You arrive at an earthen platform, at the center of which is a cement slab, 1 foot by 4 feet. This, Jordan proclaims, is an area of particular curiosity. He runs through the same demonstration that old Litster gave to the old Stumbos. Remember that? The one where Gertie Sue got taller and dumb old Hap shrunk a bit? Man, that seems like forever ago, doesn't it? He runs through that bit with my dad, who, of course, lies about his height when asked, and the lady half of the childless couple, who my dad, of course, makes a totally inappropriate comment about, and then does that weird tooth-sucking thing he does when he thinks he's said something funny. Everyone is delighted, not by my father, who they just ignore, but by the height change effect. No one loses their mind. Modern folks have seen enough TV to keep their shit together in the face of such tomfoolery. Next up, the main attraction, the shack. The shack is a faux rickety one-room cabin, carefully tilted 25 degrees. There are no straight lines in the shack, and no horizon is visible through the two windows. All you can see are trees, and they are tilted at the same angle as the shack. This is important because your mind grapes lean more heavily on a reliable horizon than you probably realize. The human brain is a fucking miracle, but it's not a precise instrument. It does its best, but sometimes its best just isn't good enough. Your brain is accustomed to everything being straight up and down, so it takes some liberties and perceives that this shack, just like 99% of everything else it encounters, is perpendicular to the ground, which means that you are the one leaning as far as your good-for-nothing, improbably complex brain can tell. To add to the illusion, the slant of the ceiling is changed to make the inside of the shack look level. Maybe a bit of the floor is actually underground. Maybe some of the supposedly right angles are a bit obtuse or acute. And that's it. That's the whole trick. 25 degrees and some trees, and you have a powerful, fully immersive optical illusion and surefire way to soak tourists for $6 apiece. The result of all this, the one that you and everyone else in your group will notice first, is that you feel nauseous as soon as you step into the cabin. This is made much worse if you have a terrible hangover, which I can tell you from unfortunate personal experience. You'll also feel very tilted, as though you were an extra in the Smooth Criminal video. Even though you are, in reality, standing up straight, you'll feel the need to steady yourself against a wall. Everyone in the group looks tilted as well. Our pal Jordan will run through a couple of fun, mind-bending experiments. He'll stand a broom on end, pour out some water, which will appear to flow up, have someone do pull-ups maybe, or lean and probably far with their arms outstretched. He'll say something about Superman while they do this. He'll roll a ball uphill and wiggle his fingers like he's magic. All of these things will, inevitably, create the optical illusion within the mind of every adult male in attendance that they know how all of this works, and they will magically begin to loudly spout their incorrect theories as though they know what the fuck they're talking about, as adult men do. Jordan thanks you for coming, and you buy a shirt, maybe, and your mom gets a Diet Pepsi, and you walk back to your car and drive another 200 miles to your actual destination while your parents argue about who forgot to bring the Twizzlers that your dad likes, even though what they really want to say is, I hate you, and I hate what I've turned into, and I would rather drive this car off the fucking road than go through another minute of this, and maybe a goddamned chocolate Twizzler will make me feel better for a fucking second, and I can't even have that. The mystery spot was fun, though. Right, kids? Thanks for listening.